Thanks for joining us here on the Bookshelf as we pick up where author John Graves left off in his treatise about making wine at home out in the country. He noted that while most enological experiments wind up as undrinkable slop, sometimes the results can be surprising and produce something that tastes, as he put it, like a rather nice dry sherry. Usually what comes out is less Epicurean than that, even if the pride of creation can make the average home practitioner give it more benefit of doubt than others are likely to extend. In its purest form, I suppose, this attitude was to be found on the Pacific Islands during World War II among dungareed makers of jungle juice, which they fabricated out of canned fruit cocktail or dried prunes or whatever, and waiving other criteria, evaluated purely on jolt. Elsewhere in later years, undoubtedly out of cultural prejudice, I've thought to see the same principle at work in such regional products as retsina and pulque. The applicable equation here seems to be alimentary tract plus alcohol in whatever form, but in sufficient quantity, yields kick plus eventual headache, and so it has ever been. Crudely put. And yet, infected with the cosmopolitanism of our time, and of whatever reading and travels lie behind us, we amateur fermenters do aspire to more civilized production. In other words, to real wine usually imbibed at least as much for the way it tastes as for whatever it does to the taster. Real wine is, of course, the transmuted juice of the grape, that magical, simple liquid which the Greeks said was brought to them by a god, and in whose honor they held great annual orgies, and which otherwise rational Frenchmen compare to sunshine itself. Imitating it well through the use of other materials than grapes is very hard and rather silly, too, since making it doesn't amount to much or doesn't seem to, as anyone knows who's watched a French or Spanish or Italian farmer laying in his year's supply. In its simplest red wine form, the process consists of gathering ripe, sweet grapes, mashing them with bare, dirty feet or otherwise, letting the whole mess bubble for some days in a tub before pressing the juice from the hulls and seeds and fermenting it still further, and finally sealing it into barrels or big pots or whole tarred animal skins where it will age before being bottled, if indeed its creator bottles it at all. The grape's sugar has obeyed the equation and turned to alcohol, and various other nice things have happened, and what results is a dry table wine, most often pretty good. But that simple transmutation is itself a miracle, and nobody knows this better than your peasant farmer himself, who may be phlegmatic concerning his wife, fatherland, religion, house, crops, and practically everything else, but is uncontainably proud of the wine he's made, and will be your brother forever if you drink some and show you like it, a phenomenon I understand better after having made a little myself. Once, many years ago, I went with a friend to the remote village of his birth on the slopes of the Gredos Mountains west of Madrid. It was August, the time of harvest festivals in those parts. The village was a pleasant one where everybody seemed to have a little usable land and a few animals and enough of life's necessities to get by well in good years. They put on a fine fiesta, too, with elaborate fireworks at midnight on a ruined castle wall, a week-long never-ceasing dance to the music of clay flutes under great poplars by a clear, swift river, fighting bulls turned loose in the main square to gore some of the town's young bravos, and in turn to be hacked and stabbed to death inchmeal with scythes and old swords and other hardware by those vengeful bravos who remained, and all sorts of further glories. But its main feature, as far as I could tell, was the sampling of other folks' wine. This wine was made and kept in numerous small caves in a mountainside above the town, some of them natural, others dug out of the dirt and rock centuries before, their entries walled up with stones and stout doors set therein. Each belonged to an individual family. In the cool dusk of their depths, big tinajas, clay pots shaped like the amphora of the ancient world, but 7 or 8 feet tall, and holding maybe 75 gallons each of last year's wine, and sometimes wine from the years before, stood in wooden racks against the walls. We clambered from cave to cave, exchanging pleasantries with their owners in the measured formal Castilian, and accepting wine drawn from the Tinaja's spigots into rough earthenware cups without handles, made especially for the fiesta, and laid in by hundreds beforehand. Occasionally there were edibles, too, bitter olives or little morsels of grilled mutton or fish or sun-cured ham or the like. Drinking with elbow high, you paid rolling compliments to each wine's particular merits, though, in truth, with the same grapes and methods prevailing in the whole village, there was no great difference from cave to cave in what burbled out of the spigots. Honest, strong red wine with a bit of an edge to it behind the chill of the mountain earth. In return for the compliments, you got more wine and great rough Spanish embraces, and when taking your leave, you raised your emptied clay bowl ritually and dashed it against the floor. By the end of the week, there was a considerable mitten of busted crockery to crunch through on our rounds, and the town had quite a few cases of what the Bible calls redness of eye and wounds without cause. And I had made a lot of new friends whose names and faces I can no longer recall. I remember the name of the village, though, and if I ever get back there, I hope it's in August and those pagan pipes are tooting ceaselessly by the river and the hillside cave wine bowls are being smashed, as most likely they've been smashed since Roman times and before. Whatever may be your own memories, if any, of old-world peasant friends and their wine, you come up against a couple of hitches when you seek to emulate them by making your own here in Texas or roundabout. The first hitch isn't serious, the fact that behind those peasant farmers' every action lie a couple of thousand years or so of family and cultural experience, whereas behind yours lies only a fervent and ignorant desire to be your own Dionysus. You can get around that trouble handily by reading books and utilizing the soft technology they lay before you, modernity's substitute for traditional feel. You learn to adjust the grape's sugar content and acidity and to guard your ripening hooch against spoilage organisms by the use of such things as fermentation locks and Camden tablets. You achieve the clarification of cloudy wine, and you become very edgy about ambient temperatures, a problem in these latitudes where grapes come ripe in summer, when the weather is too hot for prime fermenting conditions. And thus in time you stand a chance of reaching a point where you can more or less consistently make the most, or anyhow not the least, of your raw materials potential. But these raw materials themselves, the grapes, are the really big sticking point for most of us American would-be peasants, or have been until just lately. What our counterparts across the water have to work with is one variety or another of the old-world wine grape, Vitis vinifera. In this country, because of harsh winters and various diseases and parasites, the supreme and proven species grows well only in California, and a few restricted patches of territory elsewhere. As wine-minded agriculturalists from the time of Thomas Jefferson and before have had to learn the hard way. So the average American winemaker, if bored with elaborating jungle juice, has usually had to depend on the wild grapes that grow in profusion all over the continent, or in name varieties derived from them, the so-called American bunch grapes like Concord and Delaware. They make good juice and jelly, but their wine on the whole is disappointing by accepted standards. It can be, and often is, sweetened into kosher type or pop wine that isn't much different from jungle juice of whatever origin, though when disseminated commercially along with California port and Tokay, it does serve the societal function of keeping Skid Row suddenly content, except on mornings after, when sodden discontent sets in. Here in Texas, with its physical breadth and its spectrum of climates and soils, more species of wild grapes occur than anywhere else on the continent, and a corresponding diversity of tame types can be grown. In parts of the Trans-Pecos region in the west, even European vinifera will thrive, having been grown around El Paso since Spanish days, though I'm told the old winery there has folded. At the opposite end of things, in forested damp East Texas, the southern muscadine reigns, another sweet wine grape. And in between, where most of us live, a little bit of everything else can be found, subject to the vagaries of soils and germs and rots and fungi. From all these grapes, wine has been made since Caucasians first showed up. Good, bad, or indifferent wine, though mainly, alas, of the latter two types. The species most entangled with Texas tradition is the wild Mustang grape, whose thick-stemmed vines with drooping umbrella-like leaves deck trees and fences throughout the central regions of the state, from the Red to the Rio Grande. To arriving Germans in the hill country 130 years ago, those vines with their big dark grapes looked like a gift from Herr Gott. For among immigrants to Texas, these were the champion self-sufficiency enthusiasts of all time, fresh from European peasant traditions and wanting their own wine more ardently than any of us moderns can. Their heaven-directed gratitude, I'm certain, must have crumbled badly when the time came to taste the first vintage of Mustang Red, whose characteristic acidity, unless masked behind a good bit of added sugar or otherwise ameliorated, is enough to tie an unwary drinker's tongue into fancy Turk's head knots. Chronicler Texas John Duval, a contemporary of those Teutons, claimed to have once brewed up a large commercial batch of this wine that blistered and twisted the rubber boots with which he had equipped his grape tramplers, and in the end couldn't be sold because, as he put it, all who sampled it said it was too sour for vinegar and too fiery for aquafortis. But the hill Germans were and are persistent folk, and eventually they learned to cope with the Mustang grape's worst qualities and ended by shaping a sort of tradition around its wine. Even after tame grapes, not very good ones, true, adopted to the region's peculiarities were found and brought in, plenty of people there kept on making the Mustang Red. Most of us who have frequented these hills have tried it, and many of us have made some of our own. The best is more or less sweet, and of most it can be said, as of the illicit white whiskey that used to be distilled in these and more northerly limestone hills where I live, that it's not bad if you haven't got anything else to drink. Now, however, the good tame grapes are here, or seem to be, here, there, and everywhere. Nearly everyone with any interest in the subject has heard about them by now. The new French-American hybrid wine grapes that have been spreading by fits and starts in this country since their commercial introduction in the late 1940s. Their potential has been a basic motivating force behind the establishment of scores on scores of new wine-oriented vineyards, amateur or commercial, in many hitherto improbable places like Ohio, Virginia, Arkansas, Wisconsin, and Texas. Another strong factor, of course, has been the growth of wine drinking and the rise in demand and prices as more and more Americans have found out what they've been missing. These hybrid grapes, in an almost bewildering number of varieties adapted to different conditions and purposes, have been under development in France since the last century, one outgrowth of the panic that hit the European wine industry after accidentally introduced American parasites and ailments nearly wiped it out. They are in steady use over there for making not great, but good, acceptable wine. At their best, they combine the climatic hardihood and disease resistance of our native species with much of the winemaking quality of the old Dionysian vinifers. And they're doing well just about everywhere they've been tried in the U.S., thank you, except in far north, where the growing season won't give them time to ripen, and in sections of the south where endemic curses like Pierce's disease let only muscadines prosper. In Texas, much of the publicity given them so far has had a hoop-to-do commercial tone, plant grapes and get rich. It's centered mainly in the south high plains around Lubbock, where some painstaking experimentation is underway. But other nodes of hopeful activity exist or are shaping up here and there in other parts of the state. Beyond the Pecos and thereabouts, there's a parallel growth of new interest in vinifera culture. Optimism is cold-watered from time to time by sober analysts who point out it took Europe many centuries to evolve its really great grapes, adapted to restricted, often tiny regions, and to develop fine wines from them, while California is still learning after nearly 300 years of viticulture. So even with a scientific approach, could be a good span of years before we have any idea of the ultimate potential of wine grown and fermented in Texas, or in Arkansas, or Virginia, or Missouri. And it may be a few more years than that before people start getting rich out of the process, if many ever do. Somehow, though, I doubt that when all the dust settles, getting rich will prove to have been the main point. In a muted and small-scale but probably significant way, what appears to be on the verge of happening here has some resemblance to the introduction of the Vitis vinifera itself into Europe from its Middle Eastern homeland back in prehistory, whether it was brought by a god or just by some migratory bibbers. Large parts of North America are being quietly furnished with material for making native wine of adequate quality, and some is already being made. Honest wine, taken in moderation, is food like bread and cheese and meat, and has been prized forever as a staple blessing in all lands where wine grapes could be grown. It seems dubious that for all our present shrill urbanism and our insulation from earthly things, we're different enough from other men to turn down something, when offered, that has meant as much as good daily wine has always meant. I suspect that in time, and after all, what is time to the vines once here, a new and perhaps gentling element will creep into American life, born of the activities of thousands of vineyardists and winemakers, some professional, but most amateur or part-time, some hoping to cash in big, but more doing it for a little extra money or simply because they want to, who now are and in the future will be feeling out the possibilities of these grapes and their offshoots in different regions and climates. Yes, I've got mine started, something over 100 vines of 7 varieties planted last spring, of which 6 varieties are doing fine, and the other has gone chlorotically yellow and stayed that way despite applications of iron and potassium. But I expected more trouble than that in this limestone soil of mine. If in the long run just 2 sorts do well here, say 1 good red and a white, I will have what I was after and will toast my friends in my own solid wine when they come to visit. There might even be a cave as well wherein to do the toasting, for I've been studying out the possibility of gouging a great slot in the hillside behind the house with a bulldozer, then building a long stone wall cellar in it to be covered over with thick, cool earth. Maybe in a few years we can smash some clay bowls there. Chapter 6 is entitled Trash as Treasure. When a personal habit or attitude starts showing up with fair regularity in your dreams, I suppose you have to consider it ingrained for better or worse. Not long ago, after a lavish supper involving cornbread, raw onions, black-eyed peas cooked with cayenne peppers and fat salt pork, and some leftover chocolate mousse, I had a mild nightmare about being closely pursued from building to building in a shattered city by a squad of alien soldiers dressed in queer medieval uniforms, but armed with automatic rifles. While scrambling around on all fours through rubble from one ruined structure to the next, I came to a crater in which were exposed some broken electrical lines, with attached conduit connectors and service entrance heads and such other equipment. And despite the urgent hostile voices and footsteps behind me and my fear, I stopped and began prying things loose and unscrewing them and ramming them into my pockets. They were much too good and useful to be left behind. While I've never come close to attaining that degree of parsimony in waking life, I can discern in myself such a tendency as the years progress, and I know pretty well where it comes from. Its main source undoubtedly is the fact that I've led a country life during most of the past 2 decades, for among us brethren of the ruddy neck, savingness and salvage have never lost their currency, a main theme that I'll come back to presently. It derives, too, from having been a writer for 30 years, not highly productive and only occasionally salaried. Such a rogue specimen learns early in the game that for him any economic system is a jungle red in tooth and claw, and he either gets used to the idea of living sparely and making do with little when he has to, or else finds a more comfortable direction for his energies. And farther back still, this miserly inclination is rooted in experience with some fairly hard times in the 30s when I was growing up. I can't claim truly proletarian origins, but during my late childhood and adolescence, one would have needed tunnel vision and quite a rudimentary brain to stay unaware that things were very tough around and about, and to see extravagance as anything but a path to trouble and woe. Furthermore, a continuity with past human experience still existed strongly in those days, and my people, like most others, had collective remembrance of even harder times in country places and small towns, tracing back to Reconstruction, to the rich but frugal frontier, to the old world and its ways. There were wasters and spendthrifts among us, but not many. People hung on to what they had, if they had anything, and trash collectors in our town had much smaller loads of stuff to worry with on a customer per capita basis than members of that calling do today. On the other hand, the citizens of a land that was still rather lavishly endowed with good things, despite its occasional bouts of economic constipation, neither were most of us much inclined toward compulsive scrimping and salvaging, which we tended, even during a depression, to view as humorous. In our funny papers we had the Toonerville Trolley's old string saver to laugh at, and in my neighborhood we had a quiet gentleman who suddenly conceived a passion for used jars and bottles, which he could not bear to throw away, and indeed fished out of other people's garbage cans on frequent sorties along our alley with a tow sack, wearing a double-breasted suit and tie. They stood in serried, sparkling, multicolored ranks on shelves he had built for them along his back fence, outlined his flower beds and walkways, filled a disused servant's room attached to the garage, and finally started creeping up on little cat feet into the house, at about which point his family, bottles not being the only problem, committed him to the Veterans Mental Facility at Waco, and hired 2 elderly black men with a mule and a small beat-up wagon to tote off the vitreous accumulation. These haulers worked at their task for 2 or 3 days, chiefly because they were a bit touched with bottle mania themselves, and handled and loaded every item tenderly to avoid breakage, which took some doing with a springless iron-wheeled vehicle. Our amusement over something like that was nonetheless a bit wry, for we recognized it for what it was. It was just a funhouse mirror magnification and distortion of the old waste-not-want-not frugality in which a majority of us Americans then believed, whether or not we practiced it all the time. We were laughing at ourselves and at the rural past that underpinned our way. World War II marked the end of those times and the apparent end of some other things, too. In the economy of throwaways and planned obsolescence that evolved after it, wastefulness became a national virtue, a force that kept factories and businesses humming and created both jobs and wealth. It created a lot of pleasure of a sort also, freeing the general population from the old restraints like a preacher's pretty daughter turned loose in a strange and delectably sinful city, though marvelously there was no need to feel guilt. Buying a new Thunderbird you didn't need with money you didn't have, you could, if you wished, work up a glow of righteousness over your part in helping to maintain, nay, to increase, the GNP. Inexorable time has caught up with us once again forcing an end to this episode of John Graves from a Limestone Ledge, a book he subtitled Some Essays and Other Ruminations About Country Life in Texas. It's published by the University of Texas Press. The Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio. I'm Tom Bacon. Vern Windham is executive producer.